Welcome to Rooted, welcome to my yellow bench. I'm Liv Cropper and we're exploring the human side of sustainability leadership. This episode, I'm talking to Janet Greenwood. Now, she has just come to an end, or as we're speaking, she's just coming to the end of her time at KPMG, where she has led sustainable infrastructure work there for a number of years. And she's just really embarking upon a new phase of her career where she sees herself much more as a connector of people, as a systems thinker, and as a resource, in fact, to be drawn upon by people solving problems and trying to tackle the most difficult challenges that we face. It's a lovely conversation. I hope you enjoy it. Here we go. So today's guest on Rooted is Janet Greenwood. Now, Janet has just concluded a role at KPMG as their global sustainable infrastructure lead. While she was at KPMG, she was named the Times Consultant of the Year in 2024. She's a built environment professional with over 30 years experience working all across the sector, really: water, wastewater, flood defence, road, rail and construction. And there's always been a thread of sustainability really woven through her career story. She's had leadership roles at some of the UK's largest infrastructure projects, so things like Thameslink, Tideway, Lower Thames Crossing. She's also a fellow of the Institution of Civil Engineers, amongst many other advisory and academic positions. And she really works across public, private and academic sectors and has a wealth of experience and expertise. And it's such a distinguished career. Honestly, it's been difficult to even just put that bio and that introduction together. So I'd love to welcome you to Rooted, Janet Greenwood.
Well, Liv, thank you. What a lovely introduction.
And what a career. And I'm so pleased to have you join me. And I've been really looking forward to this conversation because we've not met before. So this is our first ever conversation. And so that's always a lovely thing to do, is to really get to know each other. So yeah, really looking forward to it, Janet. Thank you for joining me.
Likewise.
And shall we get going? Shall we get going?
Yes.
So just a little reminder. So on Rooted, I talk to sustainability leaders of all different flavours every episode. And I ask them a lot about their career story and their career journey. And what I'm really interested in is not the technical sustainability parts of their work, but it's really how it feels to do this work and the human side of this work. So I'm going to be digging around, Janet, if that's okay, things like, how did it feel and why did you do that and what was that like? And we're going to get into that type of conversation as far as we can. So I hope that you're up for that challenge.
I am.
Good. So shall we start? Tell me, where did your roots in this work begin? How did it all kick off for you? Because I can see you began in the engineering world. How did that career evolve and where did it begin for you?
So I think there's almost two strands there to pick up. So one is becoming an engineer, and then the other is working with a focus in sustainability. And I think my decision to become an engineer arose from my natural selection of subjects at school and a little bit of defiance that I wanted to do something that girls weren't supposed to do.
Oh, I
so
like that.
I ended up doing a degree in civil and structural engineering, and for some of the time feeling somewhat bemused that I found myself there, but I stuck with it.
And why were you bemused? Why was it? Was it because it was very male dominated, or just didn't feel aligned, or why were you like that?
I think I expected it to be male dominated. My A levels had been male dominated. I was already sort of going down that path. I had thought it would be a bit more creative, to be really blunt. I thought I'd come from, you know, I'd done an A level in design and technology where you were allowed to sort of be super creative. And then during my degree, the world word design meant something actually very constrained. You designed in accordance with a British standard, with a design code, rightly so, because you have to make sure that things stand up. But it was much more constrained than I expected. And I think it took me a while to find the opportunities for creativity within that, which lay actually outside of design. I know there are many creative designers and very talented technical designers, but I wasn't going to be one of them. So I think that, yes, that took a little while to adjust to. And then I think the other strand is around sustainability.
Yeah.
And I was very lucky that I had quite unusual parents. They were quite old when they had me. They'd lived through the Second World War. They knew what it was like to save, not to waste. I had both parents who were hugely in tune with the natural world. My father was a prolific gardener. We used to live off the garden. It was an endless process of growing, harvesting, freezing,
the true
eating.
Good life, and, good life childhood, was it?
It very much the good life. Yes. If people would come round, friends after school, there would be many good life jokes.
Yeah.
And my late mother was a biology teacher.
Right.
So we would go, they both loved the outdoors. So we'd have many a walk, and I would always be having things pointed out to me geologically, biologically. And, you know, it's really only in the last 5 or 10 years that I've realized how unusual that was, what a privilege it was. I really just hadn't thought about it until I went on a paid nature walk. And my friend was, "Isn't this fantastic?" And I thought, this was my childhood.
Right.
So I think those were the roots of the sustainability and that recognition and affinity for the natural world.
Yeah, that's amazing. And just going back, I suppose, to something you said when you were talking about your engineering time, you sort of said that feeling of you thought it might be more creative and you were grappling with or coming to terms with the fact it was a bit more constrained. Do you think in your career as it evolved, you managed to kind of resolve that and get into a type of work that still allowed you to bring that engineering skill set, but then brought in the creativity? As your career evolved, have you been able to do that, do you think? Sort of marry both those parts together?
I think at times I have been able to. There have been times when I've been able to take a different approach to a problem, whether that's a sort of people problem or an organisational problem or a sort of governance problem. But I think in terms of true creativity, it's only in the last few years when it's become really apparent to me that our old ways of thinking that have brought us to this point of crisis are not going to be the ways of thinking that take us to new solutions. And it's actually really exciting for me, and one of the reasons for taking this new direction in my career, to start exploring how we can creatively think about different ways to solve where we are at the moment.
Mm. So this is scratching a bit of an itch for you then, in terms of thinking about work and really being able to have a much more of a kind of blue sky, let's start from a bigger picture. Yeah. That seems really
exactly
exciting.
That, yes.
And you're smiling, like the listeners won't be able to tell this, but you're smiling when you're talking about it. And I can see how much you're looking forward to it.
I am. Really am.
Yeah, it's fab. And actually, as we're talking, I'm reminded of this tool that I sometimes use with my clients. It's called the GC Index. And I don't know if you've heard of it. It's a psychometric profiling, leadership profiling tool, but it's a really good one. I like it. It's one of my favorite ones. And it talks about these different proclivities or different preferences for how you like to make an impact in the world. And we've got, you know, strategist and implementation and playmaker, which is about bringing people together. But we also have this preference called game changer. And what you're talking is to me about is this game changing energy, which is, I love a blank sheet of paper. I love the idea of I'm solving a problem or I'm doing something new that's never been done before and feeling really energized and buoyed up by that. And I think it wouldn't be a traditional, you know, you wouldn't look at an engineering sort of professional and necessarily say, oh, that's going to be something they're going to be able to lean into a lot within their constraints of the profession. So yeah, it kind of feels to me like you've kind of got this game changing element within you that you need to go and stretch and try.
Yes, exactly that. I think I'm really keen to, I know that there is so much potential out there. There are so many talented individuals that I talk to on a daily basis who feel constrained and limited by the system they're working in. Mm. And I think would like to understand and intuitively know that there are connections and there are systems, but we are still thinking in silos. And I think if I can play any part in starting to unleash that potential of that amazing potential network, you know, it's not even a network yet, but start connecting up these pioneers and just see what we could create. Because it's hard for people when you are consumed by the day job in our current economic paradigm. Mm. It is really hard to find the space to think creatively. But as I say, there's a hunger for it. There's a yearning. There's an enthusiasm. There's a real appetite. And I think if we can start to get some of these people together, then perhaps we can make some progress. You know, there's going to be no one silver bullet. There is going to be no one with the plan that will fix it all. But we can all play our part. And I'm really looking forward to working with some of those talented individuals.
That's really, that's really exciting. I think there's something about sort of having enough space in our day jobs to be able to think like this and to be able to connect with others. And I think we're often constrained by kind of the time and the energy that we invest in our own roles, but also, you know, in these sort of fears of working across industries or working, you know, with different players in industries, this sort of fear of being, you know, anti-competitive and, you know, those kind of ideas can sometimes hold us back. I was at this conference, I call it a conference in inverted commas, because it was at a surfing centre in Bristol. It's called The Wave. The conference was called The Next Wave. Leifa ran it. And there was a session in the afternoon. It was all about how the finance industry can kind of put forward solutions and help with the challenges of adaptation and resilience and to climate change. And there was somebody there from a bank, and there was somebody there from an insurer, and there was somebody there from a big institutional investor. And they all stood up kind of one after the other, and they didn't know each other beforehand. They all stood up one after the other, and they told us all these things that they were doing and these things that were on their minds and the solutions they were trying to work on. And then they all kind of looked at each other and were like, we should talk to each other, shouldn't we? Because across the financial system, these are the players that should be getting together. And I think they may have all just taken away an action to do that. But yeah, it just felt very, very much like there's so much untapped opportunity when people speak to each other, isn't there?
Absolutely that. And I think we are not yet greater than the sum of our parts. We're not even the sum of our parts, I think, at the moment.
Yeah. So why don't we move along a little bit in your story? Because we've talked a bit about where it began. And your childhood and that love of nature and so on. But as you kind of look to the career that you've had so far, what parts of it stand out? What are you most proud of? Where have you made the most impact?
Oh, that's a great question. I think most recently, I'm really delighted to have played a part in creating the Major Projects Association sustainability playbook called No Planet B. It was crowdsourced about, 2 years ago now. We had an event, we got lots of people's wisdom, and then we wrote it up into a playbook, which has really gained impressive amounts of traction and government departments referring to it. And it is a relatively short document which aims to allow people working in the built environment on major projects to think, well, actually, if I am a program manager or a procurement manager, what is it that I could do at every stage of a project to just make sure that sustainability is truly embedded? And you need to do that to get a good outcome. You need it to meet your compliance consent. You need it to get good value, and you need it to bring your stakeholders on board. So it really is just good business. So the playbook is definitely one of them. I did some thought leadership for KPMG a few years ago on a whole systems approach to the built environment. I'm pretty proud of that. That arose out of a Cambridge University workshop at Cornell in the States, where we really brainstormed what it would take to have, you know, a flourishing future. And I've also done some podcasts for KPMG. So there are three that we launched this year. I think prior to that, when I was at Tideway, it was early days. The whole project was just sort of forming. I think we perhaps just come out of storming. And the op model, the operating model, needed a bit of a refresh. People were tripping over each other a little bit, and there were some gaps. And I drew up an op model. I spoke to a lot of colleagues, and that op model stayed in place for 3 years. And I think the thing I'm most proud about that is that actually it served to reduce some of the tensions and the stress amongst the team, where they were, as I say, falling over each other. And it just, I feel, had a really beneficial impact. So I'm super proud of that.
I'm hearing a real common thread in everything you've just said as well, which is that idea of bringing people together, getting everyone's input, you know, really valuing inputs and kind of trying to then synthesize that into something, and really a focus on getting people and teams to work well together and giving people structure, and how you make effective teams work and how you get effective projects and how you make it into a system that can be repeated multiple times. So yeah, there's a thread, definitely.
Yes, now you say it seems obvious. You're absolutely right. And I've been lucky enough to be involved with some, you know, great coaching and support. And you were mentioning earlier a framework to help people to reflect on their strengths. And, you know, I've been exposed to Myers-Briggs and to Insights and to the Hart Hill leadership. And I think what all of those taught me is, A, it's not science. There's no blood test. But these are really useful frameworks to start recognizing the strengths of those around you and where they will need support, and the same for yourself. And I think once you've had your eyes open to that, you cannot see things as a single person's endeavor anymore. It feels ludicrous that you would imagine that one person has got all the answers. So yeah. I think those exposure to some of that sort of coaching and those frameworks really helped my thinking that, of course, you're going to need other people's input and challenging input. And of course, whatever you create is only going to be, you know, it's what you created at that moment in time in that environment, and that will change too, but that's all okay. And it actually takes a huge pressure off any idea of a heroic perfection in terms of the individual, or B, solution perfection in terms of, you know, there is the right answer. There's a good answer for now, and maybe it's good enough and we should go with it. So I find that embracing that you are just part of a system hugely freeing, really.
Yeah, I see that too. And yeah, I think letting go of the idea of heroic perfection is quite a relaxing sort of thought, really, isn't it? It's like, oh, okay, I don't have to do it all. And also that idea that you need a multitude of different types of strengths and different types of preferences within the team. And you might know the part that you play, and if you can know the part that others play, you can relax a little bit about, you know, I don't have to, for example, for me, I don't have that energy that's sort of the blank sheet of paper, blue sky energy. But it's quite relaxing now for me to think, well, if I ever do come into that situation where I need that type of thinking, I'll bring somebody in who can help me with it. I'm not going to put it all on myself.
Give me a call.
It's not my favorite. Yeah, maybe I will. Come and help me think about this brand new thing and find somebody who loves that kind of work, not somebody who's going, oh, God, don't give me a blank sheet of paper. I don't know what to do with it, you know. So, yeah, it sounds like some really, really good sort of mantras or things to remember there, and they're just good enough and no heroic perfection. All good things to hold on to, aren't they?
Yeah.
So let me ask you then, just to, I suppose, turn to when times might have been a little bit tougher. So when work's got more challenging, are there any times there that you can share as you've gone through your career that have just felt more difficult in one way or another?
Yes. And, you know, as a young woman in construction and engineering, it's easy to reflect back on times even trying to get into university, and then times during university, then times on the construction site. And there were many occasions when, you know, I walked into the room and I was either the only woman or just one of a couple of women. When I got chartered, I was, as a chartered civil engineer, I was one of 500 women in the UK. And kudos to those 500 women who preceded me, because they must have been made of steel, I think. So there were a lot of times when, you know, the way I showed up and the way I was thinking was very different. And it's worth remembering that infrastructure and construction remains not very representative of the society that we serve.
Mm.
So whether that is gender, whether that is race, whether that's, you know, socioeconomic background, all of those sorts of things, we are better for having, you know, the only reason for building this stuff is to make people's lives easier. And if we don't understand those people's lives, we're not going to be building the right stuff. So I think things are definitely improved on the gender front. I think there's still work to do. And then I think the other,
I was going to ask you what that was actually like back, you know, in that period of time where you were trying to make your way in this career. Sort of early career is always hard, you know, in terms of finding your feet and finding the groove and so on. But how did that manifest, that feeling of I might be the only woman in the room, or how does it feel there?
I really remember being on site, and it has to be said, I was one of a number of Wessex Water graduates, and some of the young guys on site didn't have it. You know, they also had a really tough time on site.
Mm.
This was construction sites in the early 90s. And I particularly remember, you know, I was the assistant resident engineer on a site miles from anywhere with all of these guys working. And I was therefore in charge of the site on behalf of the client. So it was my job to make sure what was built was right. And I discovered that the piles, the sort of columns into the ground that would support this enormous tank, they'd only put the reinforcing steel half the way down. So instead of 6 meters, they'd only put the steel in the top 3 meters, and therefore it would not be as strong. But of course, once you've built that, you can't just push the steel further down. It's concrete's gone off. And when I realized this, because I was watching them and watching them put the steel cages in, and I had to go up to this guy who, in fairness to him, thinking about his perspective, he was running a small business. You know, this was not somewhere with big margins. And I had to say to him, you have done it wrong. This is not what the drawings say. It's not good enough. It won't stand up. And therefore, we have got to work out a solution. And it may be that you've got to rebuild them. And, you know, I will not be the only young person, male or female, who's experienced this on site. But, you know, having somebody, you know, their face 12 inches away from yours, absolutely losing it.
Mm.
And just having to stand there and stand your ground. You know, the fact that I can describe this, you know, I remember it was 3 meters and 6 meters. You know, this was an absolute
burned on your
formative
memory. Yeah.
Experience. And there were many others. You know, as a young graduate at the Institution of Civil Engineers, we had the president come to the London Graduates and Students meeting. And this chap, and I'm sure he talked over many people, male or female, but he absolutely talked over the meeting. And I remember getting him to stop talking so that I could finish what I was going to say. He was a little taken aback.
Yeah, but it takes a lot, actually, as you know, if you're in your 20s or your 30s, it takes a lot to kind of be able to do that. And it sounds like you managed it. It sounds like you, yeah, stood your ground. That must have felt good.
Yeah, I think I like things to be fair.
Mm.
And where I perceive they're not being fair, then I am prepared to do what I can. Yeah. So I think that for me is quite a strong driver. So it's not really a question that goes through my mind of should I do this? I'm already doing it by the time I've even thought about it. So,
yeah. And what about, I mean, as you say, it's not so prevalent. We hope and we think these days it's somewhat more balanced than some of the practices we would hope have fallen by the wayside. But what would you say to somebody in that phase of their career, in that position of being, you know, the only woman in the room, or the only, you know, in some way sort of through demographics kind of standing out, being the only minority in a room, for example? What would you whisper in their ear, you know, to kind of help them along the way?
Well, in fact, I did have a conversation with someone at the beginning of their career who was faced with a bit of an ethical dilemma where they felt they should take a course of action that was right, and they were being pushed into a course of action that was convenient. And I said to them, your gut feeling was right. You have good judgment and you should listen to that, because you were right. You were right to think this isn't okay. I don't think I can go along with it. I think be true to your principles, to your core.
Yeah.
Try and assume positive intent on the parts of others. Everyone's got something going on, and it may be that you might interpret something as being rude, but you know, perhaps it wasn't intended that way. So perhaps, you know, giving a bit of leeway and considering the benefit of doubt. And
it's not easy to do, though, is it? That idea of assuming positive intent, you know, it's something I talk about a lot in the coaching room, that idea of, you know, we try and go into every interaction from a place of what we call it, you know, I'm okay, you're okay, is the way that we phrase it. Mm-hmm. It's that sort of sense of we're on a level, and I'm assuming the best of you and you assume the best of me, and we'll kind of go into it as adults, like transactional analysis, really, I'm talking about. But yeah, it's actually when you're in the thick of it and somebody's in front of you shouting in your face or whatever, then it can be really hard. And I guess we can't beat ourselves up if we don't always, you know, achieve that.
And I think there's a few really powerful words. One is and. You don't have to negate what somebody else is saying. You can add to it. And another one is yet. So, you know, you might come out of an interaction and think, do you know what? I failed. It wasn't what I wanted to do. I'm disappointed. But I think all you can really say to yourself is, I haven't got there yet.
Yeah.
That's helped me. I've learned from that. And next time I will.
Yeah.
So I think yet is a really powerful word.
Yeah. That's, you see that in the, I see that in the kids' classrooms, in the primary school classrooms a lot, actually. They have that, you know, I don't know yet. And they really drum it in, actually, at school. Certainly the schools that my kids have been to, they've really drummed in that idea of, I don't know yet.
That's fabulous.
And they keep on like chucking that in. So my kids now say it back to me, you know, sometimes, because it's just been literally like rote learned into them, that whenever you say I don't know, you add yet onto the end of it. Yeah.
And just on that, you've made me think of when my kids were at school, and they're past school now, the teachers there were talking about Carol Dweck's mindset, and that, yeah, for me 15-20 years ago was an absolute, oh my goodness, yes, yeah, we're all works in progress. And keeping your mind open to what could be is super powerful. I think in terms of being the challenging nature, I think the other example I would give was around, I've realised I'm definitely a systems thinker.
Mm.
I connect things, and that has strengths and weaknesses. And there are, our system at the moment, our paradigm is very much silo, do things discreetly, and of course it's very helpful to get things done. If you want to just get a project done, then being more of a silo thinker is hugely beneficial. But being a system thinker with a lot of silo thinkers was quite a challenge a number of times before I really had the words to describe what I now see, I think, what was going on. So yeah, understanding thinking styles and realizing that I love to see the big picture, the connections, the system, the interconnections, and that for other people, I am talking about rainbow and they're seeing in black and white. And that's fine, because they will do other things far better than I will.
Yeah, and that must be very frustrating, though, when you're in it and you haven't quite got that way of describing it, to sort of feel like, why isn't everybody aligned on this? Why don't you get it?
Yeah, absolutely. I think for a long time I didn't understand why a point I would make wouldn't land, or why people would do things that I thought made no sense. And I think understanding that there are different ways of seeing the world has been, you know, hugely beneficial.
Hmm. And what's helped with that? Because you said about, you know, before you got the language to talk about it. So would you say you now have a way of articulating it that helps?
I think there's been a general sort of societal shift to recognising that systems thinking is a thing, that it's different from systems engineering, that it isn't so much about, you know, mechanical systems talking to each other or mechanical parts. I think there's been a much greater shift. You know, thank you, Daniela Meadows, for helping us. And there's courses you can do now in systems thinking. And because our siloed approach to the world is taking it to the brink. And so I think systems thinking is necessarily having its day as we see the evidence of our own eyes that our old ways of doing are not, are destructive and counterproductive. Mm. So I think there's been a bit of a sort of a societal movement to systems thinking. And yes, starting to be exposed to some of that thinking has really helped.
And I think, you know, the more you you work with the top teams of very large, complex organisations, the more you're on boards and things, you know, that's where that type of thinking must be surely so valuable, because these boards or these teams are grappling with the most complex of challenges within organisations and working within different sectors and industries and so on. So it sort of feels like... Do you feel like your skills and your preference for working in that way and thinking in that way is kind of aligned to the type of work you want to do more of in the future? Kind of more like working across bigger organizations and sectors and industries and things?
Definitely. That's definitely where I see quite a lot of my energy going. Mm. I think we are hampered by our accounting systems and our economic systems, which both have very short-term horizons. You know, what's in this year's accounts?
Yeah.
What's in this year's budget? Would I get re-elected in the next couple of years? You know, these things don't help. But CEO tenures, you know, I don't know the average number of years, but, you know, it's unless it's a family-run business, you're looking at relatively short tenures.
Yeah.
And I think the economic model as well only allows us to count money. And that means that we do not place any value on child rearing, on child care, on volunteering, on the natural world. And all of these things are absolutely essential to our survival. And yet we are only counting a made-up construct called money to fit into our made-up construct called economics. Mm. When the only real things are butterflies and rain and sense of community and love. And my very first boss when I was at Wessex Water used to talk about the concept of smile hours, and I've never forgotten that. Wouldn't that be wonderful if we could count smile hours? But I think we do need metrics. Can obviously drive poor behaviors as people drive towards targets, but I do think we need to be valuing things other than money. And I think if you look around us at the multiple crises we have, you know, gosh, that's a coincidence. Everything's come to crisis point at the same time. We've got a mental health crisis in the young. Mm. We've got economic crisis. We've got air quality crisis. We've got, well, I wonder if there's a root cause to all of this. I wonder if there are some deeper solutions that we could start to look at, which would mean that we don't have to come up with 20 or 40 different solutions, all of which overlap and detract from each other. Perhaps we could come up with a few root cause solutions, and they would just naturally deliver co-benefits without anyone having to work terribly hard at it. And where my thinking is now going, and I'm learning from really great experts from the Center for Natural Intelligence, Lynn Gorrison, all about regenerative thinking, I think, need to shift to a world where we view ourselves as a part of this amazing planet, just one species in the web of life that provides us with an environment in which we can survive. And I think as soon as we start to recognize we need a reciprocal relationship with our planet, then things will start to shift. A very wise colleague of mine, Lammy, said to me, "Janet, we don't have an environmental problem. We have a social problem." And I think that's very true. Mm. We could fix all of this pretty much tomorrow, but people are struggling to adjust to new ways of thinking and new ways of doing.
Mm. It's such an inspiring and it's a very clear mission and philosophy, the way that you articulate it. I'm wondering how you how you can channel that, you know, and how you can now out of the, let's call it the constraints of corporate life, how you can channel that mission and that philosophy. Do you have a clear view yet of how you might do that? I use the word yet, by the way. So
so it's emerging, which is a regenerative principle. There's definitely, if you're familiar with the Bacana two loops model, you've got the old system that's dying and then the new system that's growing. And that new system starts with pioneers who get connected into networks, who start communities of practice and build new institutions. I definitely see myself in the space of connecting the pioneers into networks. And I've got lots of ideas about how I might do that. I'm also keen to share the knowledge that I've gained so far, because everybody is terribly time constrained. All of the good work is being done side of the desk. The money isn't flowing where we need to at the moment. So I'm quite keen to do a bit of a I've read it so you don't have to. Here is something you might find interesting.
Yeah.
So I like there's something idea. Around
yeah,
that.
Yeah, I do a bit of that sometimes. My pile of books, it's probably not the same as your pile, but my pile of books, I'm like, okay, I'm going to read these 25 books. And then if I like one, I'll let you know, which is probably the way of doing it. Because there's so much, isn't there? There's so much to be consumed, actually. It's helpful for somebody to do that and go, yeah, I have taken the time to kind of really deeply engage with this. And here's the stuff that you really need to know or that could be really inspiring or helpful to you.
Yes, and I do find myself doing that quite a lot anyway and enjoying doing it. So I think, well, I might just do more of that. I really do enjoy it when someone says, oh, I'm stuck here. And then I say, oh, have you thought about this person? Have you read that book? Do you know that network?
Yeah.
And the leaders at the Regenesis Institute, who trained Lean Gorison, who I mentioned earlier, they now call themselves resources. And I love that. And I think actually, yeah, I'd like to be a resource for the next few years for industry, for colleagues, for younger colleagues. I'd like to be a resource. Ask me and I'll tell you what I know. And maybe it's not helpful and maybe it's rubbish, but I'll happily tell you what I know. So that's really keen. And then my sort of final thing, which is super difficult, but we need to start getting money flowing into this just in the short term, and just small pieces of work, 50k here, 100k there. So whether that is philanthropic funding, whether that is government research or innovation funding, we need to start joining up with better pieces of work. And there are lots of experts out there who are really well placed to deliver that work. So I think that's number three on the list, because that feels pretty tough, because I'm sure lots of people have tried. Nonetheless, we do need to start getting money funneled into some discrete pieces of work that can start to enable people to deliver in the way that we all intuitively know we have to. Most people, you know, we're sitting here sweltering at the in the heat wave. And I think most people know that we've got to do things differently.
Yeah. And it feels like you've got all that knowledge and that professional experience and expertise that you've built up over the years in all these different sectors and all these different kind of contexts. And that lovely idea, I love that. Just now you want to be a resource and a connector to try and enable and facilitate something new coming, which is really, really important. It sounds cool. It sounds, for somebody like me who's a bit who's not in the blue sky thinking sort of preference, it sounds a bit scary to me, this idea of like I'm going to be sort of embarking upon something that's emerging and I don't know where it's going to lead me and I don't know quite what, you know. But to you, I can imagine it's really inspiring and kind of really energizing to embark upon this.
It really is, and I think it's such a privilege to be old at this point. It really is, because I'm not at the beginning of my career. I am at the
You're
point
not old,
now where
so.
I can do that.
I mean, where do we define old? We're not old.
I feel hugely privileged that I'm able to take a few years just to do this. And yes, I don't know where it will go, but I'm excited to find out.
And maybe we should do a little, if anyone's listening to the podcast and feels like something you've said kind of resonates for them or something they're working on that might benefit from a bit of connecting or a bit of systems thinking, then we know where to find you now, don't we? So
absolutely.
I mean, everyone I think who listens to this podcast has an involvement with sustainability in one way, shape or form, but there is quite a diversity in terms of different types of sectors and different types of work that people do. So, yeah, maybe there's someone out there who's got a problem you can help them with. I've got a final question, but I'm going to ask it, but I feel like you may have already answered it about 10 times already. So just tell me. What you think. I was going to ask you what sort of seed of wisdom or advice you would give to others making their way through this kind of purpose-driven world that we're in, or purpose-driven career that we're in. Do you have any, I guess, concluding thoughts around that? You have given an awful lot already.
I think it is really important, where you are able to zoom out, to challenge the constraints and the assumptions of whatever task or issue or problem you've been given to deal with, and actually go one step. There's the sort of the Japanese five whys, you know, why won't the car start, etc., etc. And I think unpicking your assumptions, because otherwise we end up solving the manifestations of problems rather than the root causes of problems. And we do not have the time and we do not have the resources to do that. So zoom out and ask the questions and think about the assumptions and what's implicitly behind whatever it is that you're being asked to do. Because it may be you can swerve the problem entirely. It may be that you can dodge it, or that the problem actually lies somewhere else. I'll just share a very brief anecdote. I think my eyes were opened when I was about 14, and my school friend had a terrible knee. She was a really good athlete, and she nearly went to have knee surgery. But she went to see a foot specialist, and they said, actually, you've got a problem with your arch in your foot. And that blew my mind, that the cause of the problem could be somewhere else entirely. And what she needed was orthotics. She didn't need knee surgery. So she could have had that knee surgery, and then 5 years later, she would have needed more knee surgery. And I think that's where we're at the moment. We keep doing knee surgery when actually some cheaper orthotics might really help.
Yeah, that's such good advice. I, as you were talking, I was thinking of a client I have, and he said to me this morning, he said, you know, I'm working on these PowerPoint decks and we're on the sort of 16th iteration. And I think he's, you know, tearing his hair out thinking, what's it all about? You know, like, especially if you've been drawn into this work for, you know, wanting to make an impact, wanting to solve some of these really challenging, difficult problems we have in the world. And then you find yourself in iterations of PowerPoint decks, and that feeling of zooming out, asking the question. But there's also another bit there, which is being brave enough to ask the question, you know, and being feeling able to do that, and that you don't just want to go yes and I'll get on with it quietly and do a good job for whatever you've asked me to do. So there's a bit of that as well, of having the courage to ask why a number of times, be a bit challenging, could we look at this from another angle? That's not always easy to do, is it?
It's not. And, you know, my first reaction with the PowerPoint deck is, what's the point of the PowerPoint deck? What do you want it to achieve? Do you want to change? Do you want to inform people, give them new knowledge? Is that the best way of doing it? Do you want them to change their behavior? Is that the best way of doing that? What is the problem you're trying to fix? And I'm a really visual person, so don't get me wrong, I love a bit of PowerPoint. But it may be a kinesthetic experience, walking with people around the site of wherever it is you're going to build, or I don't know, just approaching the problem in a different way, or doing some kind of team exercise might be more impactful than a beautiful slide. You know, it breaks my heart because I do love a beautiful slide, but yeah. just taking a step back and thinking, sorry, what are we trying to achieve here? I think it's yeah. always worth it.
Yeah, that's great. Lovely, a lovely piece of advice to end on. I've loved talking to you. I've loved hearing about your philosophy about things and how you approach your work and what's important to you in this next part of your career. It's been wonderful to do that and to get to know you. Thank you. Thank you for joining me.
Liv, it's been my privilege. Thank you so much.
Oh, thanks, Janet. Let's leave it there then. And yeah, thank you so much. So there we go. That's my conversation with Janet, which I absolutely loved. Despite the heat, we were recording this in the midst of the May heatwave and just about managed to string sentences together, I think, and just about managed to have a good conversation and a really wide-ranging conversation. So I do hope you've enjoyed that. I think the thing that I'm going to take away from that was Janet's way of thinking about things, taking us away from the silos that we can often get ourselves stuck into and encouraging us to take a step back, question what we're doing and why, think about, is there a different way of doing this? Is there a bigger picture that we need to look at? Are there other people that we need to bring into this question? And just encouraging us, I think, yeah, to take a slightly different look at the work that we're doing and see if there are different ways of solving the problems. So that's the message I'm going to take away from my conversation with Janet. And I'd love to hear what you think of it. Please do share your comments, send me an email, put a comment on LinkedIn, whatever. And as always, please do share the podcast with anybody you think might enjoy it. If you've got a colleague or a friend who you think might like it, then please help me spread the word. Thanks again for listening. Bye.